Hello. This is a podcast for our class on October 13, and it was class number 15. And in this class, we finished up talking about the element of duty. We've spent a whole long time on this one particular element. One, two, three, four, five, six classes. More than that, seven, eight classes on duty. Why? Because it's a preliminary question, and it's a policy question that sets the entire standard for liability for a cause of action for negligence. It's the question you have to get over and answer. So duty is something, unless it's a clear activity that you're doing, which is driving a car or operating a train or running a machine in a factory, unless it's a clear action, in which case we say there's always a duty to use reasonable care, anything else you're going to have to answer that duty question. So if, as we've seen, there are, and duty is can be used to expand liability or limit liability. We've seen areas where it's expanded, where we were a little surprised by it. Randy V. Murak, I mean, you know, it was quite an expansion far beyond what the defendants did to hold them liable for the rape of a schoolgirl, but, you know, policy reason for expanding it. Tarasoff, policy reason for expanding. All of these things that we've seen as a duty question all starts from our notion of where do we want this responsibility to lie? Where do we want the responsibility for this injury to go? So, again, distinguish between affirmative duties and just your ordinary duty of reasonable care when you're doing something. On the quiz, a lot of people got confused about this notion of common carrier or special relationship. It's not, unless we're talking about a very special circumstance, you don't need a special relationship when you're doing an activity. Common carrier duty is only relevant if you're talking about affirmative duties, not regular, you know, running your train. It's not a question, you know, there's not a duty because they're a common carrier. They're a duty that because they're doing something, they have a duty of reasonable care. Their duty under common carrier, special relationship, comes in under affirmative duties. They have to come to your aid. They have to give you the warning when they didn't have to otherwise. So it's you know, it's important at this point that you've got these distinctions down and clear, because they're the basis for the entire cause of action. And here we've come across the second type of non-physical harm that has special duties and rules. Remember, we said before, everything we've talked to up until now has been about physical harm to your person or your property. Now we have non-physical harm, and that's, we've talked about just emotional distress standing alone, and now we've moved on to pure economic loss. Economic loss that is not accompanying a physical injury. That means injury to your person or your property. The Hammond Tree v. Jenner, Hammond Tree's the bicycle shop. Car went through the bicycle shop. That was a physical injury. So we always say, you know, torts is involved with the injury to your person or your property. Economic loss, pure economic loss, is a physical injury. Pure economic loss is unassociated with the physical injury. I'm sorry, I misspoke. I'm going to say it again. Pure economic loss is economic loss standing alone. Doesn't have the car going through the bicycle shop. Just losing something without any physicality to it. And there, again, there's sort of two different types. The thing, you can make an analogy to the emotional distress cases. Two different types of pure economic loss. First is direct negligence that directly affects your economics. And the next is indirect negligence to someone else that has economic loss, causes economic loss to a third party, sort of like the bystander. So there's physical injury to somewhere, and we have bystander economic loss. In the first case, we talked about, and the courts don't like these, this type of loss. We've seen it before in emotional distress, although the courts will allow it. They're even tougher on pure economic loss. Why? I made the theory, and I think it's a valid one, that when we're talking about monetary loss alone without any physical relationship, it's just a matter of economists would say, you know, shifting one person's loss to another party. It's sort of a zero-sum game. I say that the court thinks, well, if you're that dependent upon loss of your business or some business transaction, you should insure against that. You could easily insure against it just as much as the defendant. And back to what economics this gets into law and economics, and torts is an economic concept. The Coase theorem, for which Professor Coase won a Nobel Peace Award Nobel Prize a number of years ago, Coase theorem says whether one prisoner pays at a certain point, it doesn't really matter. It's a zero-sum game. And this pure economic loss is exactly what he was thinking about. So the courts sort of feel if it's just money, who cares? You know, obviously the person who lost the money cares, but you're just shifting money around from one person to another. That this is outside the realm of what we've been talking about, what we talked about in class, but it's, you know, you should be aware of the economic theories behind this. Anyway, we talked about the NICAL KPMG case, and this was, we had KPMG, there were the accountants, they very negligently, you know, wrote their auditing statement, really lousy, bad accountants, and which showed that the company was healthy, showed that Gulfoil was healthy. NICAL came along, and obviously it read the statement and invested, you know, bought a lot of stock, and then it went bankrupt 2 years after they bought the company stock, the controlling company stock. Now they're looking around and they're trying to sue the accountant for misrepresentation. Issue is going to be duty of the accountant to NICAL. And the court talks about privity of contract. Otherwise, there would be no duty. There's no floating duty. The duty has to be based on the contract between Gulf Oil and Pete Marwick, KPMG Pete Marwick. Does it benefit? Was it made to benefit a third party? And we see third-party beneficiaries. You should be talking about this in contracts. Third-party beneficiaries, can they run to enforce the contract? This has a little glimmer of this concept. Does the duty run, you know, there's a duty to the other party of the contract, does it run to a third party? And the court says, well, maybe, very limited duty, possibly, maybe. It depends. And then they go into what does it depend on? Well, it could have a foreseeability test. Is it foreseeable that somebody would rely on this negligently performed audit statement? Is it foreseeable? Then maybe the duty runs to anybody to who it's foreseeable, reasonably foreseeable, not possibly foreseeable. Or as in New York's Ultramares case, which is still good law in New York, is there some relationship between the plaintiff and the defendant that approaches privity, so it would be okay to have the duty in the court here. So that's too restrictive. Ultramarins requires, it's too restrictive, and the most restrictive part is this requirement of contact between the two parties somehow. And then we come to the final test, which is this negligent misrepresentation test, is articulated in Restatement 552, which allows there to be, under certain circumstances, a duty to run to the injured but non-party to the contract, to the third party. And the requirement here says that the people making up, there has to be reliance, but the people who do the audit had to know that they was going for this particular transaction. And the court says, well, we like this test. It's not too narrow. It's not too wide. And if we apply it here, there's no way our KPMG could have known that it was going for this particular transaction. Why? Because the transaction started before they did their audit. Was, you know, they were looking at this quite this stock purchase a long time before the audit came out in 1990, and they didn't know even, you know, they hadn't, the auditors had no knowledge that this stock purchase was even being contemplated. So the court said in this case it doesn't apply. 552 is going to be a rule, but it doesn't apply. You know, ask your question. We talked about it in class. Didn't they know that their audit was being used for some purpose? For some purpose, they have to know this exact purpose. So, no, not enough connection. We talked about attorney liability cases. Maybe those were even, you know, those certainly aren't floodgate cases. It's a very narrow ambit of possible plaintiffs. Even that, you know, courts look askance at that. And then we talked about this bystander economic loss as delineated in the Madison Avenue case. Crane Falls didn't injure any of our plaintiffs for these actions, but it cost them a lot of money because they had to close their businesses down because of danger to others on the street. There was no physical injury, no physical injury to them at all. It's the streets were closed. They could have started. They were ready to do business. The streets were closed. So they had no physical injury whatsoever involved. I think it's important. I think there was a question in class, and I didn't address it directly enough. They could have done their, they were ready to operate business, but they couldn't operate it because the streets were closed because of this crane fall. So they had no physical injury whatsoever. It wasn't that the crane fell on the deli or the chocolate store. It's that the streets in the area were closed and they lost business because customers couldn't get to them. And the court said, you know, we're not going to go here. Other jurisdictions have. New Jersey and People Express opened the door to a foreseeability test, but we don't want to have to make that distinction. Bystander economic loss, in this case, we're just, you know, tort is there to allocate risks and allocate loss. The risk is, we're going to put the risk all on one side and the loss all on one side. We're not going to get into this line drawing or zone or it's close in proximity and distance. New York says, no, hold the line. Again, jurisdiction by jurisdiction, I always said in any of these special non-fiscal injury cases, there's very much difference between jurisdictions, but you have to know that all courts are not interested. All courts are very leery of these kinds of cases. Then we moved again out of duty, completely out of duty, into cause in fact or actual cause, our third element in our tort. Our cause of action for negligence. Now, I said duty breach, that equals negligence, then we move to cause in fact. But the same thing will apply when we talk about intentional torts. We have to prove the intent, but causation all of the rules for causation, cause in fact, proximate cause, will be the same when we talk about intentional torts. We won't repeat it, but it will still apply to a cause of action for intentional torts. Still needs a cause in fact. It still needs proximate cause. Cause in fact, you frequently hear it referred to as but-for causation. And this is the rule I want you to use. That's the first thing that you should use. And usually, it's, you know, it's a question of fact, and usually it's not that difficult to prove. You know, but for your negligent driving, you wouldn't have hit the plaintiff. So cause in fact, all you have to do, if it's that something that simple, cause in fact can be described in one sentence. Proximate cause is going to be tricky. Proximate cause limits cause in fact, puts a limit to cause in fact, stops it because cause in fact can go into infinity. But cause in fact, there are problems with it. One of the problems that comes up with cause in fact, one of the problems that comes up is the fact that sometimes when there are two causes, there are two causes to a fatality. You know, we got one result here, but two causes. But four won't work. It will get rid of, you know, either one of the negligent or criminal parties would get off. Both of them, it allows both of them to get off, and because neither can be said to be the but-for cause. So I use the example, Alan stabs Clara with a knife, Betty fractures Clara's skull with a rock. Either would be fatal, but four would allow both of them to get off for the death of Clara. So the substantial factor rule, Restatement 431, has been used when the conduct of each of two negligent defendants or intentional defendants would have been sufficient to cause plaintiff's harm. An application of the but-for rule would allow both to escape liability. The court uses substantial factor. It's a statement of legal significance, not of quantum. What does that mean? It just means they're going to say you're the cause. Usually cause, in fact, isn't tough, but when it is, it's really tough. We very, very quickly went through the Stubbs case. It's not difficult. The concepts are pretty straightforward. But it's very, it's similar to a lot of problems that you have when you come up against toxic tort, environmental harms. You come down with an illness, but there are any number of causes to this illness. How can you show that one type of negligence has caused your illness? It's impossible. In Stubbs, he had typhoid, but there were 10 ways to get typhoid. Our defendant was only responsible for one of the ways, the polluting of their drink water. And they were clearly negligent. They had a duty to keep the water clear. That was their job. And they were negligent in doing it. It was River City, Rochester. This was an operation. This was a proprietary activity running the water system. And they messed it up. Water doesn't get polluted. They did not use reasonable care. The water got polluted. Question here, are there enough facts regarding causation to send this to the jury? Remember our standard for burden of proof, preponderance of the evidence, more likely than not, 51%, not just possible but probable. Here, the only thing that the plaintiff could show was that the water was contaminated, yes, and he got typhoid, but he had no way to link the typhoid to the water. He drank the water, so did a whole lot of other people, and they didn't get typhoid. A lot of other people who got typhoid didn't drink the water. Even if the water hadn't been polluted, people would have gotten typhoid that year. So there was a lot of evidence, a lot of stuff, but it was not possible for the plaintiff to show what the cause of his typhoid was. And it wasn't possible for the plaintiff to eliminate all other possible causes. even if you can use circumstantial evidence, expert testimony, all of the full arsenal of evidence, our plaintiff could not make those two statements that the defendant wanted. The plaintiff didn't establish where he got typhoid, whether he got typhoid from the water, and didn't establish that he didn't get it from any other source. So couldn't make a positive link or a negative link. Because it just wasn't possible. There are other ways to get typhoid, and the plaintiff couldn't eliminate them as possibilities. So why isn't our plaintiff out the out of luck? Because the court didn't adopt the defendant's jury instruction when there are several possible causes of injury for one or more of which the defendant is not responsible. Plaintiff cannot recover without proving that the injury was sustained wholly or in part by a cause for which defendant was responsible, page 343, which means you'd have to show what caused the illness. The court looked at the all of this evidence in the light most favorable to the plaintiff, decided that even though they couldn't establish 100%, because correlation, even though there was definitely a high correlation, correlation isn't causation, they couldn't establish anything to a reasonable certainty, the court adopts a rule. They couldn't establish it for but for causation. The court adopts the rule of something they call reasonable certainty. If two or more possible causes exist, here we had 10, for only one of which defendant may be liable, that was the case, and a party injured establishes facts from which it can be said with a reasonable certainty that the direct cause of the injury was the one for which defendant was liable, the party has complied with the rules. Page 344. More flexible than the rule the defendant asked for sure, and allows you to get to the jury. It doesn't mean the plaintiff wins. It just says there's enough evidence, plaintiff has brought forth enough evidence that a jury could decide with reasonable certainty that his injury was caused by the negligence of the defendant. It's enough to get you to a jury verdict either way on the same evidence, allows the jury to infer causation. We've seen this before with inferring negligence, inferring breach, allows the jury to infer it and get you to a jury. Now, this reasonable certainty, again, it's not 100%. So you know that some plaintiffs are going to get to the jury with less than 100%. If we use reasonable certainty, it's definitely less than 100% sure. And we know that some plaintiffs, plaintiffs every year before this water got polluted, people in the city of Rochester got typhoid. Half of the people would have gotten typhoid. So there's no way of knowing which ones deserve recovery from the water company. There's a chance of overcompensation or undercompensation. But regardless of these probabilities, you have to make a decision. Sometimes undeserving plaintiffs will get something they didn't deserve. More likely than not, they won't. But if that's our standard of care, we don't look for 100%. We don't look for beyond a reasonable doubt. More likely than not, this is what caused our plaintiff's injury. And it gets you to the jury where they can decide that. So our court says, but four is our primary test for actual causation. But if you have a lot of different causes, and the defendant's only responsible for one, a lot of different potential causes, defendant's only responsible for one, our plaintiff only has to show to a reasonable certainty that that one is the cause of the injury in question. So the reasonable certainty test doesn't supplant but-for. But-for still works, but reasonable certainty allows some additional plaintiffs to get to the jury when they otherwise would not be able to. So next class, we're going to start with Zukowicz. It's a difficult, complicated case. It's like Stubbs, the other toxic tort cases where causation is hard to show. But it's a difficult case to read. You're going to have to be careful with this, careful reading it. Please read these carefully, and so we can have a good discussion, because these toxic tort cases or drug cases are increasingly part of the litigation landscape, and you have to know how to be able to address them when they come up. So Zukowicz, we start this next class.